I wrote this piece in college. It's about my best friend's father, Richard Lamartine. It seems stupid that someone should drive a Cutlass F-85, but then ride to their grave in a big black Cadillac. People get strung out about funeral etiquette, and their behavior is often totally inconsistent with the character of the person being buried. My best friend's father was a fantastically beautiful person, not perfect or saintly by any means, but beautiful. He had quit school in the 8th grade in order to support his family. He was the oldest son. He'd been a messenger in the stock market in 1929 when the crash came and had stayed up night and day for almost a whole week, a story that he loved to tell us. I don't know where to start in describing him. He was a big man with a mustache and gray hair. Judy was always proud of the way he dressed, penny loafers, button-down shirts, and his pipe. He reminded me, especially in the old photo albums, of Clark Gable. His mind matched his appearance. He had educated himself in math and the sciences, as well as the arts and humanities. One end of their living room was completely lined with beautiful books on every possible subject, and Mr. Lamartine could discuss any one of them with authority. He could be really narrow-minded at times. When discussing literature, you always had to be really well-armed with facts, and even then, he just might tell you that you were wrong, and that would be the end of the discussion. But when something is truly precious to someone, it's often hard for them to accept someone's blundering comments, and if the blunderer loves the critical party enough, she accepts his criticism without feeling slighted. Another passion of his was acting. He was very active in the local theater group, the Playcrafters, and was really quite good. Judy and I always got to go to the productions. He also had an excellent singing voice. Often after dinner, Judy and I would sit on his knees, and the three of us would sing with him harmonizing. He was the first person who Judy and I sang for after we had formed a singing group. The only instruments we had at that point were 2 bongo drums, and we had matching navy blue skirts and white Oxford cloth blouses. Very collegiate. We covered the lamps in their living room with newspapers, making them into imitation spotlights, and then we sang for Richard and his wife Jean. After we were finished singing, we ran upstairs, got pens and paper, rolled up our sleeves, hung unlit cigarettes from our mouths, and came back down to the living room for autographs. It sounds so corny now, but we took it very seriously at the time, and they gave us their encouragement and support from then on, never complaining about the new and different types of people we started bringing home, always taking the time to listen and get to know them before making any judgments. Musically, Mr. Lamartine's taste was totally different from ours. He was an opera fanatic, and on Sundays, the whole house was dedicated to listening to whatever opera they were featuring on the radio that day. When I say the whole house, I mean just that, as he liked the radio at full volume. It was also his day for cooking something special. I've never in my life met anyone who got such joy out of cooking and who did it so well, my own mother included. They never had instant coffee or instant breakfast at their house. Sunday breakfast was always home-baked biscuits or wild rice pancakes or some other carefully cooked delight. Dinner, too, was always something that took the whole day to prepare. I remember one day he plucked a pheasant for dinner, and Astrid, their exchange student from Austria, took the feathers and made little ornaments by sewing them together. We saved them to hang on the Christmas tree long after Astrid had returned to Austria, married, and had children. Christmas was the best time of all at their house. Mr. Lamartine had saved the ornaments from his childhood in the Bronx, and each one had a story all its own. No matter how well we knew them, we would ask him to tell them again each Christmas. We'd string cranberries and popcorn for the tree, and sometimes we made candy houses, too, snitching the candy off the back of the houses so they were half bare before New Year's. Every year, Mrs. Lamartine tried to make a Christmas cover for this old clock that sat on their mantelpiece, and every year we'd have to laugh because it always came out looking funny, but it was just as big a part of Christmas as the lights on the tree or the stockings on the chimney. There were never many presents. Mr. Lamartine worked for Westinghouse as a public relations man, but they were always good things, carefully chosen and beautifully wrapped, nothing plastic or artificial. Christmas Day, the relatives would come over. Aunt Dady and Uncle George were the most fun. She was this wild woman who always wore insane clothes and laughed and screamed and kissed you 10 million times because it was Christmas or her birthday or something, and she was a million years old. Uncle George was a Mr. Magoo type of man, quiet but funny, happy to let Dady carry the party. Bobbin would be there too, Mrs. Lamartine's mother, a quiet, gentle woman who was always nice to talk to. There were other relatives and wine and candles and all sorts of food, and the kids would all go upstairs and play games. Sometimes they'd call us downstairs to sing for them, which was always fun. Relatives were nice audiences, except for their knack of asking us to sing Where Have All the Flowers Gone, long after we deleted it from our repertoire. Every season pleased Richard. In the spring, he would take us to the park. Sometimes it was Coney Island, and sometimes it was Palisades Park. We'd go on all the rides and then walk the boardwalk and eat potato niches. He and Astrid had the courage to go on the parachute jump, but Judy and I just stuck to the steeplechase. Even better than the parks, though, were the Italian street fair and sidewalk exhibits in the village. They'd let Judy and I go off by ourselves and eat lunch in a Spanish cafe and listen to Henry play the flute at the Café Wa and wander among the icons and crucifixes and Ferris wheels and food stands for hours on end. Judy and I wore our matching blue gingham dresses. We often wore twin clothes, sometimes because we bought them to sing in, and sometimes just because, having identical taste, we'd bought the same things. I still remember one fat bearded beatnik sitting in a wheelbarrow and looking at us and laughing in amazement as we walked through Washington Square staring at all the groovy weird people. We'd brought our guitars in case we ran into any jam sessions, but we left them in the trunk of the car because they'd just passed the permit rule, and we had our doubts about just how eager people would be to play guitars with eighth graders in matching gingham dresses. We never worried about losing Judy's parents. Mr. L had a special whistle for calling us. It was a tiny piece of some tune, no more than 5 notes, but they were unmistakable. He was an excellent whistler. Richard also loved poker and horse racing and bridge, and was pretty lucky at the first two most of the time, and always very talented at the latter. Once a year, he'd go down to the island for a weekend with the fellows for poker and racing. The island reduced him to a little kid. He'd love to go down to the docks and watch the fishing boats, or just sit on a jetty and savor it all. For several summers, they rented a house on the island for a couple weeks. He and my mom used to cook up some of the wildest dishes. They were good at feeding us blowfish smothered in tomatoes and garlic right before we left for a beach party, and then giving us dried parsley for our breath. If you're ever given that choice, stick with the garlic. One day, Judy and I came home from school and were listening to the record player when the phone rang, and it was a woman from Richard's office. Mr. Lamartine had had a heart attack and been taken to the hospital. Mrs. Lamartine was there with him. This woman just wanted to tell us that Richard's car was at the Bloomfield office and could be picked up at any time. My mom wasn't home, so we had no car. We just sat there in silence. It seemed somehow barbaric to continue listening to records. Then Judy's mom came home with Richard's clothes and said that he had pulled through all right, although he was in intensive care. There's something awful about bringing home someone's clothes. 2 days later, he had another severe coronary, and Auntie Alma heard a doctor in the coffee shop say that it was a miracle that he survived. We'd go down and visit him every day. I wasn't really family, but they said I could go up. He was home in 3 weeks, never suspecting how close he'd been to death, just being happy to get home to his music and his cooking. He didn't tell us until after he'd been home for a week that he was going back into the hospital to have an operation. He had a tumor in his colon. Again, we started our daily trips to the hospital, praying that he'd pull through. Amazingly enough, he did. And in another week or so, he was home again. At first, they just let him visit home for lunch, making him return back to the hospital by dark. He'd be so excited and happy to be home then. I remember him sitting in his black leather chair, having Grand Marnier and letting us sample it. He was good like that, always trying to introduce us to things we hadn't met yet, even with books. One night he read us The Cask of the Amontillado because we couldn't think of anything to do and had never read anything by Poe. I liked the Grand Marnier because it tasted like orange blossoms. He told me that if I ever decided to become an alcoholic, I should do it with Grand Marnier. Finally, he got home from the hospital. That weekend, I went down to the shore. When I got home Sunday night, I called Judy, my usual procedure upon returning from any place. When she answered the phone, all I could hear was screaming, and she said she'd call me back. At about 11, she came over and told me that they'd been sitting at the table when all of a sudden her father had had a stroke, at just about the time that I called. The ambulance had come and they'd taken him to the hospital. They didn't know how bad the damage was, but things did not look good. 2 days later, he lapsed into a coma. Judy didn't go see him, as her mom said that it was just as well that she didn't. We just kept saying, he's come through too much to be struck down now. But one evening on the way to the Cauldron dinner, Judy and I had a joint column in the school paper, Judy just looked at me and said, my father's going to die. And I didn't know what to say. There was no way I could help her, except by just being there, just being her friend. The following day, my great aunt died. It wasn't an unhappy death, as she'd lived a very long and full life and had died with no pain, letting everyone know that she was ready and willing to leave. On the way down to the funeral, my mom said that Mrs. Schwarzy, the town gossip, who I've never been able to bring myself to tolerate, had talked to Judy's aunt and that Mr. Lamartine could only have another day or two to live. I don't think I've ever hated anyone as I hated Mrs. Schwarzy at that moment. She had no right to take away the little speck of hope I had managed to cling to, no right to pry into a very personal crisis. I spent the rest of the day hoping, praying, that I would get home before it happened, that I would be there when Judy needed me. We didn't get home until late that night. In the morning, Judy called me to say that Richard had died the day before and that she'd been trying to get a hold of me all day. I was to go to school for the first couple periods, then I had to go and get a pair of shoes to wear, then pick up Judy and see if I had anything that would be appropriate for her to wear. She'd never been very big on dress clothes. There was a big row about the funeral, as Mrs. Lamartine, Laurie, and Judy wanted them to read Shakespeare, since he was Mr. Lamartine's favorite playwright. But the rest of the family and the funeral home people said that would never do, that they must have the usual type service. Mrs. Lamartine had never been a strong person. Richard had always taken care of the family rows, so the family went out. The service at the funeral home was so irrelevant that I didn't really pay attention. The thing that really moved me was the unexpected presence of two people who Judy and I had always loved and known, but who in no way were obligated to come. The advisor of our school newspaper had been our Latin teacher in junior high school, as well as our journalism teacher in high school, and just a good friend. He was the first black person I'd ever known, which made him even more special for some reason. The vice principal of our school was the real force behind the school. He was strict but fair, feared but respected. The principal was soft and arbitrary with his punishment. He was the type of guy that starts out really benevolent in an insincere way, trying to con the kids into thinking he's the greatest, and then gets a bad break and becomes a holy terror, refusing to listen to anything but his own opinion of a situation. The students hated him. The only reason he was the principal was because he had his doctorate and the other man didn't. Well, anyway, as I sat there staring at the coffin and wondering where Judy was, in walks our teacher and our vice principal. I'll never be able to be completely disillusioned in a world in which there exist those kinds of concerned, beautifully kind people. I could go on, but I'm not sure where I would go to a joking, beer-drinking family reunion back at the house afterwards with an uncle that looks so much like Judy's father that it made me want to smile and cry at the same time. To Judy looking around for me in the crowd at the burial site and telling me with her eyes, since the age of 7, people have accused us of having a way of talking to each other without saying a word, to meet her back at the house. Of us standing in a bathroom in an apartment in Brooklyn a year later, Judy stoned and me drunk, crying and trying to put the whole thing, the whole 14 years, into words. Of some rich classmate's grandmother who moved into their house and redid our den and took down all the Degas and painted the red brick front white. Could I say that, believing in neither God nor heaven, I still can't help but feel that someday she and I will sit again in that den with the smell of spaghetti sauce simmering in the kitchen and the foreign notes of the weekly opera pulsating through the house.